You're listening to the Decentered Media podcast with me, Rob Watson. Conversations about community media. Visit decentered.co.uk or follow on Instagram and Twitter at Decentered Media. Hello, it's Thursday the 2nd of September. This is a Decentered Media podcast with me, Rob Watson. And today I'm joined by Don O'Neill, who is the author of a really excellent book, The Lack of Care Act 2014, and by Jane Muir, who is a parent carer. I'm going to get them to explain a little bit about themselves in a second, but the nature of the conversation that we're going to have today is about how people who are in my language probably isn't quite right with this, so you guys can tell me at any point if I'm not phrasing something in the best way possible. But people who are kind of or engaged in or subject to or part of the Social Care Act, and what that means and how that affects people. But I think what's really my interest is how those stories are related and how people make sense of their experience and use our media to share and learn about that experience as well. So that's a pretty ham-fisted kind of introduction. I'm not saying I've kind of got that, it's not smooth and gliding along, but Don, do you just want to tell us a little bit, introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you are, what your kind of story is, in the key headlines, and we'll go into detail in a bit more later.
Yeah, my name's Don O'Neill. I had a spinal injury in 1983 when I was 16. My neck was broken while I was playing rugby. After that, I spent about a year in hospital and went on to do my A-levels at a college in Alton called Lord Mayor Trelaw College. Then went to the Poly in Oxford and then after that left full-time education. So since 1983, I've been a user of social care. And I've been an adult since 1955, so since 1985, I've been an adult social care user and just been on the receiving end of the service, which I think has been failing for the past 20 years. But I will leave that there and to let Jane introduce herself.
Yeah. Well, I agree it's been failing, yeah. And that's how we met, really, isn't it? But my son is now 30, and he's got cerebral palsy, quite severe cerebral palsy physically, and mild learning disability. But he went off to college for 3 years, a specialist college for physical disability after school. And then he went to another kind of college for the performing arts for people with young people with disabilities after that. So for 3 years, so that was 6 years. And then he came home to live, and then we had a little team of carers at home using direct payments from social services in Oxfordshire. And then he decided he'd like to go and live in a residential home for young people on the South Coast. And I thought, well, I'm getting on a bit and maybe that's a good idea. I'm finding things quite a struggle sometimes. But after 6 months there, the whole place just collapsed. The management just gave up. And I realised that he wasn't safe there and I had to take him home again. So since then, again, we've had a small team of carers coming to the house who we get to know quite well. But it's always me organising everything and covering for people. And I feel I'm getting really tired now. I'm in my mid-60s and I'm just getting very, very tired. And there really isn't. I suppose the main reason I've come onto this podcast is because I agree with everything Don says is in his book. And I think that if there's been one massive battle I've had to tackle all these years that's caused me the most stress, then it's my battle with social services. And yet my son is somebody who, without a doubt, needs the top level of social care. So why I should have to battle and fight all the time, year after year after year, with social services of all people who you would think would be the people who are there to help you, it's just so aggravating. That's why
I think that kind of encapsulates, Don, if you don't mind me saying this, the nature of the book and the really powerful testimony that you bring together in the book. Jane's experience seems to typify a lot of other people's experiences. So let's kind of recap a little bit in terms of what got you into writing the book. What was the motivation for that?
So I've been an adult social care user for over 30 years, 35 years. And for at least 20 years, it just hasn't been going well. It hasn't been going right. But I've been involved in numerous consultations. I've answered lots of questionnaires about how to improve adult social care. But nothing seems to change. It just doesn't seem to improve. And for me, it's been pretty good. It could be improved. But people I know, and you just think, how can it be this bad? And there's legislation there to provide a good service so people get enough care. People are just getting enough of that care. And I just wasn't quite sure how to make a change. Because I've been part of consultations, answered questionnaires, but nothing's changed. So I just wanted to put my voice out there and also the voice of other people who I know or by a friend of a friend, and just tell the story as it is, how it's, people have been failed by the actual system.
Mm. And if you think that Don and I are both educated, reasonably intelligent, articulate people, so if we find the system is failing and we have to fight, then, you know, heaven only knows how people who are less articulate, less educated or whatever manage.
I mean, the core theme of the book for me is one, you do emphasise a positive side to the social care ethos, which is independence, but the dysfunction comes from a kind of managerialism and an overemphasis on process. And it struck me as kind of like, you know, I haven't had to engage with social services ever in my lifetime, and my family generally doesn't. So these are things I've not experienced. But the kind of the shift from what a social role, my idea of what a role of a social worker was somehow an advocate and a champion for the people who are at risk in society. But they're not anymore, are they? They are process managers.
They're budget holders.
Yeah.
I think also for me, the main thing was, with the Care Act 2014, to me it brought a whole new philosophy about how care should be done. In the past, you might get someone who might come in and get you out of bed, give you breakfast, pop back at lunchtime to give you a sandwich and take you to the toilet, pop back at tea time to use the toilet, then pop back at supper time to give you a meal and put you to bed. And it was just looking after the basics, having to exist. With the Care Act, the philosophy was well-being. And I'm just going to read you a bit from the... Is that okay? I'll read you a bit from the Act itself. The first few lines. It says, "The general duty of a local authority in exercising the function under this part, in the case of an individual, is to promote that individual's well-being." And it gives a list of things to do with well-being, to do with personal dignity, physical and mental health, protection from abuse, control over the individual's day-to-day life, participation in work, education, training, social and economic well-being, domestic and family personal relationships, sustainability of living accommodation, and the individual's contribution to society. So this whole philosophy goes beyond just helping you get out of bed and being fed and doing the basics. It's looking at your life. What is it you want to do with your life, and how can social services help you, empower you to live that life, to live rather than exist? And I think the Care Act itself is a good act. You know, it offers so much. But I don't think that much has changed since 2014, you know, when the Act came in, because it's still the same for many people. It's still the old philosophy of, we just nip in, do a bit of care, nip out, and we'll help you to exist, but not live. We won't help you to participate in society. We won't help you to help you achieve what you want to achieve. We're just still doing the basics. And that's where it's going so badly wrong for many people.
And there's a number of factors that you identify as, if you like, causes which are brought together for that, running themes that contribute to this sense of dysfunction, which is one is the kind of lack of money, so austerity, you know, the lack of money that's put into local authorities and specifically into social care. Then there's the fragmentation of service provision via contracted out, self-employment, that kind of thing. And then the other one is as we've said, a kind of focus on budget holding and managerialism of that process, as if that's the only thing that matters.
But I mean, money is an issue, but money isn't the main issue, because in some places, some things are being done well. In some places, you think, well, if you can do this well over here, why can't what they're doing well in, say, Staffordshire be done well throughout the whole of the UK? Because people have a similar amounts of money. And to me, it's not so much the money all the time, it's more how they use the money, because they often waste it on stupid initiatives which don't actually do something, and they don't actually improve people's lives on a day-to-day basis. And the people in charge of adult social care, and ultimately it's county councillors, who are just random people who get elected in an election, who know nothing about adult social care most of the time, that they shouldn't really be in charge of this area. I mean, this is a budget of hundreds of millions of pounds. And if you had a company with a turnover of hundreds of millions of pounds, you'd have someone in charge of that company who knew about the actual area of work. But often the county councillor is a random person. And the problem is, I don't think local authorities use their money as efficiently as they could, because they often commission services which don't do what they ought to be doing, and also it's not the right service for the people, because it just doesn't provide the need that they actually need.
It's very fashionable at the moment across a lot of public services to talk about things like the lived experience of the service user and co-production and those kind of phrases. And you're very blunt, I think, is the best way to describe some of the views that you've rightly come to about the process and the experience of these things. It's often a fig leaf. It's often temporary. It's often something which is just, you know, it disappears. You never hear back from things. And I've done other public engagement and consultation exercises where people are repeatedly saying, look, you know, we get asked all the time what our views are on this, but nothing ever changes and nothing
it
ever...
It feels like it's just token asking, so they can tick the box that said consulted with service users, you know, but it doesn't actually mean anything.
Does this come from, just trying to think of what the kind of... the root causes, if you like, of this? Is this like a civic decision? We've started to look at this as process management, almost like a kind of, you know, what was introduced with things like universal care was behaviorism and nudge theory and management along processing, and thinking that only if you put people in this economic framework, then they'll somehow figure out what the rest of it is. And we've stopped looking at people as citizens with rights, And that sense of entitlement to a meaningful, productive life.
I think there's the real distrust of anybody who's vulnerable and in need of funding on any level in any part of society, that immediately, well, can they be trusted? Are they going to run away with the money, kind of thing? And I feel that, you know, my son's given a really good budget to spend every year. I have no argument with that at all. But he can only spend it in certain very, very delineated ways, which, you know, we can't be creative. They don't like us to be creative with it or to find better ways of doing things. Or, you know, they really like to, you know, they want to know exactly. I don't know, it doesn't make sense the way they do. I end up giving back thousands sometimes because we haven't been able to spend it in the way that would be best for us.
And this is the whole point, it's about the structure of how it's run. I mean, so when Jane and I met, we were at the consultation about how to improve adult social care. We were sat by the table with other service users or representatives of groups of people who use the service, and a couple of commissioning officers from the local authority. We were there for about an hour and a half. At the end of the meeting, we gave our point of view about what needs to happen to move forward, and we gave our summary, and they didn't like what they didn't like what they heard, and so they were going to put down what they wanted to put down. And I said to them, are you just going to ignore our comments and put down what you want to put down for yourself? And they said, well, yes, we are, because they didn't really explain it well, but essentially they didn't want to change, really. And after the meeting, they said, well, let's meet up 2 months' time and carry on. And 2 months' time came and went. And I emailed the person higher than them and said, well, what's happening with this consultation? And they said, well, we decided to put a consultation on hold this time being. And that's more than 2 years ago now. And nothing's happened. And the problem is, systems need to change. And I think people, I don't know, but I think maybe people who work in the local authority feel a bit threatened. And maybe they're just there to save their job. Or if there's a big shakeup, maybe they won't be in control and they fear losing control. But something needs to change, and it's just run so poorly that money's being wasted and people aren't getting the care they need.
I want to go into a little bit more detail about the motivation for the book, because this is something that I want to lead on to, which is these conversations are often done in private meetings and through minutes, which are maybe put up on a website somewhere that nobody ever seems to access. And kind of, I suppose what I would suggest that we do is things like podcasts, and we put it out and put it on the radio, you know, do open up this discussion so that these views are constantly talked about and not talked for people, but by people. So we've got a media, I'll get into this in a bit more detail, but we've got a media that does things to people and it doesn't reflect people's experience or expression of what they regard as important. But we've got the technology like this now, like using online platforms and Zoom and things like that to repurpose these and refunction these. So let's get into that in a bit. But so the book, what was the thought process? What was the deciding issue? Because writing a book is not an easy thing to do. And you know, what was the support that you got for that? How did that come about?
I've been wanting to write the book for many years, and I just haven't got around to it. And then last year, March, lockdown started. I was stuck inside and had to stay inside for about a year and a quarter. And I thought, well, this is a good time to start. And I just started. But after about a month, it just wasn't going well. So I put it aside and had to rethink how I was going to do it. There was no narrative running through the whole book. It was just disjointed. And then I thought, well, let's just pin it on the Care Act. You know, refer back to the Care Act all the way through different bits that should be happening and why they aren't happening and how it affects people. But also, rather just include my voice, the voice of other people. And I just interviewed people on Zoom, actually, and got the audio, had it auto-transcribed and typed it all up. But the main thing was just to get across the message that, you know, it's not just me. There are other people out there who have care needs, and they're saying similar things, that the social worker isn't that great. They don't listen to me. I'm too scared to talk to my social worker. They have that. If I talk to them or ask for anything, they cut my budget. It's just appalling. And the idea that the system needs to change, but they don't want to ask anyone how to improve it and take off all their comments. I mean, at the very highest level, I think adult social care users should be involved of how it's run on a day-to-day basis. But the key question is, when they spend money, is how is this going to improve people's lives on a day-to-day basis? And a lot of what they do just doesn't do that. It's wasteful.
I've got a blunt question to ask you, yeah, but I'll paraphrase it first. You've gone down the independent publishing route, I'm assuming?
Yes.
So... most people would have editors and kind of a team of people. You've clearly liaised with other people about it. This is the blunt question. I do apologise for it, but what qualifies you to write a book and to say these things independently? Because I that's what I really like about it, that you've been able to do that. But you know, what is it that, you know, what is it that kind of said, hang on a minute, I can self-publish this. I don't need to go. I've got experience. I'm not very, you know, when I was an academic, I'm not very well published because I could never do the trawling around journals and book publishers to try and find what it was that they wanted. And you've kind of, you know, sat down at the pandemic and gone, right, okay, I'm doing this.
I mean, what qualifies me is my personal experience and also the people, you know, the other case studies in there also, their personal experience. But just over the years, I mean, over 35 years of being on the receiving end of a service. And when you're on the receiving end, you learn a lot about it. And when you have friends who are on the receiving end, similar things crop up about not enough care or, you know, interactions with social workers or communications from the local authority, you know, being threatened, being bullied. I just thought, and the problem is for me, is that most books about adult social care or social work, they're written by people who work in the area, either social workers or higher up managers or academics. Now, I've not seen many books written by people on the receiving end. And also, you're right, I am quite blunt and I wasn't going to sugarcoat it. You know, there's no point in me. A lot of books paint a rosy picture of what life is like for a social worker and how the care system works. It isn't working perfectly. And I just say that in quite a blunt way because I'm not too bothered about whether people like to. So I'm not trying to offend anyone. I'm just trying to get across in very plain English how bad some bits are. And yes, it might offend some people, but the idea is to get across the, you know, the problem that people are experiencing on a day-to-day basis. Because some people are experiencing some really terrible problems. The idea that you can get a care budget and not have enough money in your budget so you can go out and do your own shopping is just incredible to me. It's just incredible. And the idea that on some mornings you have to choose between having your breakfast made for you or having the bed sheets changed, it's just ridiculous. In this day and age, 2021, even after the Care Act, where it's all about well-being, it's just ridiculous.
Jane, do you get a sense from media that, if assuming that you engage with other forms of media and platforms, and do you get a sense that these issues are being treated generally openly and fairly, or is it hard to come by accurate information? What's the kind of sense then? Because you've expressed a strong sense of frustration about being able to, I think this is how I would read what you've said so far, about being able to communicate these issues, this experience that you have, but it's not openly shared. It's like in private networks and through networks that you've now established with Don and other people, but the general sense of understanding in society as formed through our media, what's your view of that?
I don't think until people use the social care system that they really have any idea. And to be honest, I quite often just feel as if as soon as you have a serious disability, and obviously I haven't myself, but you know, my son has, so I've been very involved in that world, you can just feel that you're quite literally living on another planet from everybody else sometimes. That there's just no understanding at all from, because, you know, a lot of people think, oh God, wouldn't that be awful? That poor thing, oh, dreadful, you know, to be, you know, and they just assume whenever I talk to somebody about, oh, I've got a problem with this, that, or the other, they say, oh well, can't you ask social services, or can't you ask, you know, there must be somebody in the NHS you can ask. And I said, no, actually there isn't anyone I can ask. There isn't anyone to help me with that. I have to find solutions to every single problem we have myself. I have to do it myself or it's not going to get done. And so I like to be able to use the money that we're given in the best way I can. And I have done, everybody that knows me thinks that I've done a really good job over the last 30 years. But I've had to really push the boundaries to enable my son to have a good life, you know.
And Jane's done a brilliant job. But the thing is, it shouldn't be a fight every day for 30 years. It shouldn't be that way. It's just incredible. I mean, to me, this is part of the issue with local authorities. There's no independent support. I mean, in some areas, in some local authorities, there are user-led organisations. So organisations of disabled people who are there to help other people, and they can help them in a really good way because they have their own personal experience to add to it and say, well, yeah, that happened to me, you need to do A, B, and C. Me, I feel that anyone who, say someone has an issue and suddenly needs care, as soon as they contact social services, if you can find the phone number, because it's so hard to find the phone number.
Yeah. And when you phone up, it's hard, very hard to get anybody you can talk to. You have to talk to the duty officer. And the duty officer is somebody who is fielding all the phone calls. And then they'll put you through to somebody else at some stage, maybe a week later. And then you get assignated a social worker, and you have to change who the social worker is. Every time there's another issue, you have to have a different social worker and start all over again, explaining everything right from the beginning, all over again. Oh, and you can't get hold of them anyway. And it's just...
It's true. I mean, I'm still waiting for a call back from social services from last Thursday. It's 7 days later. I said, oh, yeah, don't worry, someone will call you back. I'm still waiting.
Yeah, exactly.
But the main thing is, as soon as you make contact and they feel you need an assessment, what they ought to be doing, I think, is putting you in touch with a local user-led organisation who can give you support. Because if you go to that initial assessment without support, without knowing the questions you're going to have to answer and how to answer the questions, you may get a budget to support your care needs. But by that time, it's too late, because you'll come out of that meeting and you'll realise that this budget is not big enough to actually support your needs. And to try and increase that budget is so hard.
Oh, and again, it's taken us a year to get a reassessment of Raphael's needs. I asked them to do an assessment last September, and it's taken 12 whole months for them not to do an assessment, to do a reassessment. And eventually his budget was increased. And so we kind of won. We got what we wanted. But that was 12 months of me, you know, saying, I can't plan for the next few years if you don't tell me how much budget we've got. And they just wouldn't tell me. And they wouldn't answer the phone. And they,
And this is the issue, because without support, it's so hard. And I think most people would give up within 12 months.
Yeah,
and most people are just too scared to complain, or too scared to actually get an increase.
I actually put in an official complaint eventually through the complaints people at the City Council. And presumably that's what made the budget suddenly come through, was that I'd put in this official complaint.
Essentially, the more belligerent you are, and also the more educated, I've got a master's degree, and you know, if you're educated, belligerent, you're more likely to get what you get. But it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that.
You are educated and belligerent, you still have to battle. You have to enter the fray, you know, and...
It's like a sealed labyrinth that nobody explains how it works.
That's a good way of describing it.
Well, it's the kind of Kafkaesque, isn't it? You know, it's become it seems absurd. And Don, I think you do a really fantastic job in the book of bringing that to life. And that kind of counterpoint between what's described, and you do it in some detail, of what's actually stated in the Social Care Act, the testimony, and then the process that people have to go through. I think those three elements, and your personal experience as well, it kind of really brings a very strong, you know, I would highly recommend, you know, people picking up this, and anybody who goes thinking of going into social work of any kind or public administration should read this.
Thing is that the last social worker we had, well, no, it was the one before the last, when Raph was at the care home for 6 months, she was a very nice young girl. She'd just come out of university doing a social care degree. And as we were walking along the street together, I said, oh, so you specialised in disability, did you, in your social work degree? And she said, oh, no, not at all. She said it was just a general social work degree. And then I just happened to get a job in disability. And I thought, well, no wonder she doesn't know a single thing about our needs.
And the structure of our public services has become such that we don't have those layers of acquired experience. You know, a lot of people you get, you know, you can't, people I know who work in public authorities can't wait to get to retirement and get out. You know, and there's the, you know, it's not seen, you know, it's been squeezed so much that kind of tacit institutional knowledge that used to be there is kind of pushed aside. And you know, I think the expression that you use is it the strengths model that you identified, Don, which is like people talk about, you know, it's not about money, but it's about looking at the assets that people have. And you're very, and I think rightly, critical of that as a kind of way of saying, actually, it is about money. It is about capacity. It is about resources. It is about having enough people there who've got the knowledge to be able to understand and deal with the problem and to support you, rather than it just being about their internal performance indicators and yeah, budgets.
It supports the main thing. I mean, one person I talked to for this book, one of the case studies, I asked him, I said, so when Kara went on a holiday and she was going to have no care for 4 weeks because she was too scared to ask the social worker. I said, well, why don't you just get a different carer? And she goes, well, I've got no idea where to find a carer. And that to me is, again, under the Care Act, social workers are meant to provide you with information that would be relevant to you, information that they feel you may need to help you function. And it's not enough for me for someone to give you a direct payment, so rather than get your care via a care agency, the funding, your care budget is given to you directly, and you can employ carers yourself and have more control. But just to give someone a direct payment and say, okay, here's the money, run along now and get on with it, and not have any support about how they can find a carer, employ a carer, because once you start employing a carer, you're an employer.
Yeah, and it's difficult being an employer. I mean, for me, it's been a real learning process to have to, you know, I know you, Don, have one carer for, is it 6 weeks, and then they change over or something?
Yeah, so, I've been there for years. And
But for us, we work in a different way where we have a little team and they do maybe 1 or 2 days each. And so I'm the employer of 4 or 5 people who come and work in our home. And I find that incredibly stressful sometimes. Just having someone, I'm sure you know, Don, just having someone in your home, it's so intrusive. You know, it's really difficult because people who've never been disabled or had those needs, they don't know how intrusive it is to have somebody always in your home. You know,
yeah, when someone comes and starts, it's someone new to you, just again, some random person you've had to employ, and they're in your home, but also, for me, the main thing is you're an employer. Employment law applies, and employment law is complex, which is why there are lawyers there, and you can so easily trip up. And if you're given support, you know it's easier to actually make sure you comply with the law. But a lot of people just not given support, and a lot of people don't
it's
know.
It's a whole job that you have to take on from scratch on your own and learn how to do it at home. By yourself?
An interesting question. The lockdown has forced a lot of people, as you say, who never normally have had to consider issues like this about isolation, into thinking about how we can use online networks. And I'm certainly not an advocate that everything that we do should become digital. I think we've got to look at every opportunity to connect people and to communicate. But has there been... The use of online support groups and Facebook groups and video conferencing and wherever platforms that you've had access to, has that made the sharing of this experiences between different people easier to bring together?
Well, as far as I know, in this area, there's no forum for that to happen. There's no forum for direct payment users or adult social care users to
come
together.
No, they keep us apart, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, everyone just lives their separate life. I mean, it's only people you know, like your friends. I met Jane a couple of years ago at a consultation. I've got other friends who's out of social care. So when I have an issue, I might phone up a friend and say, oh, this happened to me. You know, did it happen to you? And can you give me any answers or any clues about how I can approach this? So it's more informal networks, but there's no actual structured network. There's no actual structured support system where people can actually talk to each other and just post a question to a forum and get answers. But that isn't there.
And is there the informal networks of Facebook groups, are people connected via
not
those?
Not that one, no.
I mean, that's remarkable in many ways, isn't it? Because there's Facebook groups for pretty much everything, whatever you're interested in, there seems to be a Facebook group there, but we've not brought that together for people.
I think it's because, if you're using carers and all the rest of it, you really want to have some time where you can just leave all that alone and get on with your life. You know, you don't want to be spending all the in-between times talking about it all. And I mean, I'm doing this podcast now, but I often don't take part in things because I just think, come on, enough. You know, I want to live my life. as well as, you know, get Ralph's care sorted and then live my life, please.
And again, this is why I feel that if there was support locally of a user-led organisation, that there could be a one-stop shop where any question you had, they could either answer the question or put you in touch with the person who could answer the question. At the minute, it's so disparate that there's someone does this, another private company does something else, and also you just don't know who does what. I mean, around here locally, there was a direct payment users support service. I had no idea who it was, and it closed down recently, and it's just been taken over and been brought back in house by the local authority. No notification in the
That, because I was thinking, is it me? Have I missed something? Because they said it was going to change into another organisation, and then we never got told who it was or anything.
It's just the basics. You know, so if you want support, you need to know where to go to. They didn't tell you where to go to. And now, sorry, just one more. Now the thing is, for support, they've got a list of 12 approved supporters, and none of whom are local. For me, the support people need is someone who is local and someone who can come around your house and explain things clearly to your face. Because most people, the problem is we don't know what we don't know. And most people don't know what questions they need to be asking to find the answers they actually need.
It's kind of like there's two polar pulls in two different directions. One is the structural the lack of consistent support, and what you've just been describing then sounds like one of those management exercises in, oh, we'll find a provider that we can give them a telephone hotline to, and there we go, we've solved the problem. But we're not actually taking any responsibility for this ourselves as individuals, as professionals or as public servants. And the second one is the lack of confidence or the lack of civic empowerment for people who are dependent on the social care system to actually self-organise and to have networks which are, you know, clearly based around advocating for improvement and advocating and discussing in public domains and being served by, promoting conversations which people can then share that kind of insight and experience. One of the things that really frustrates me is, and a lot of charities and civic sector organisations do this, is their communications becomes about marketing and branding, how wonderful they are as an organisation, and not about sharing the experience of the people that they're there to serve. So you get this kind of, everything's wonderful, isn't it amazing? Oh, we're at this event and this is fantastic, and we've done this and we've done that. And you ask people, has it made any difference? And you can't answer that. People go, well, we don't know. And then what you get is you get the testimony from people to say, actually, it's not making any difference at all. You know, it's actually counterproductive what you're doing because you're not engaging and listening to the things that we've identified.
That dreadful line that they got hold of a few years ago, which was my life, my choice, which I always joke is my life, no choice. You know, so they'll blandy it around everywhere. You know, my life, my choice. This is, you know, you've got a choice of this, and this, these are your options, but they're not real options.
Don, you described this as, you know, it's kind of the picking up of a slogan and a tagline, which becomes, you know, you express somebody's aspiration about it. So what we...
Sharing the care, that's another one.
What do we do to change this? What do we do to start to bring about a different sense that we can engage with this in different ways?
You probably hear me audibly roll my eyes just now when you mentioned that. Yes, it's the users. It's people who are on the receiving end of the service. And these new companies locally, where they've just given them a contract to provide support, the actual knowledge that they would probably give back to people is within service users. If there was a forum or a user-led organisation supported by the local authority, you know, users working there and users' personal knowledge would be able to supply all the answers to the questions.
I mean, my initial thought from, you know, reading the book is that this needs to be transferred from, if you like, a municipal service support to a cooperative. Is that I don't see why you're not all working as a co-op where you have, you know, you buy into the organisation itself and control of the budgets and pooling your support. And but that doesn't seem to be, you know, it's like individual, it's privatized to you as individuals. There we go, you've got your personal budget, you've got your choice. But it doesn't work. I think Jane's expressed that really, really well. And it bangs up against the restrictions that local authorities feel that they could, they're the boundaries that they're constricted by, that they have to work within. But mutual society, civic society, is full of people working collectively to organise on for themselves and advocate for themselves. But that seems to me the missing element to this.
It's true. And I think that could happen if it was supported by, say, in some areas around the country, there are what's called Centres for Independent Living. So they are user-led organisations that are disabled people who are there for disabled people, and they provide the support that's needed. And that needs to happen to me in every local authority. And if you had that, yeah, it could be led by the community. It could be, and the main thing is, it's the user's knowledge could go into that organisation, and they could give the support that's needed for adult social care users. You know, just having, because most people don't know where they can go to for support, and yeah, the idea of having support that is run by users is best. You don't want it by the local authority because they don't really know what they're doing. And I phoned up the local authority here about the new in-house direct payment support service, and I just said, look, you're in chaos. And you just need to get service users around the table and help you to plan what the system ought to be, help you to run it, but you know, nothing.
And no sense that there is the political will to actually give that transfer of ownership over to the service users themselves. Is there a better phrase than service users? I'd really like to find a better phrase.
Service users is fine, yeah.
Yeah, but they you know, but nobody sits in and says, well, actually, you know what? There is another model that we could do this. It's a long tradition of, I mean, Beveridge in the 1940s wrote a third report, which is about the structuring of mutual aid societies. I think it's something Hilary Coatham talks about.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a whole tradition that we've kind of, we went down the route with the National Health Service, and people are thinking about a national care service of kind of putting state controlled. Now, I agree that there has to be kind of minimum standards, but they can come from professional practice and better education. I think if you go across to the Nordic countries, their social work practice, you wouldn't get to be, as Jane described, you wouldn't get to be a social worker unless you've gone through a process, not just of attending one university degree, but a postgraduate degree, and then having a number of years of apprenticeship, if you like, in the job before you could call yourself a qualified social worker. Sure, and we've stripped all of that away.
But I think that does exist in some areas. And the problem is, it's random. Let's say you get a new director of adult social care coming to your local authority, and that person is personally keen on co-production, real co-production, getting users involved, and things could change overnight. But then 5 years down the line, that person might leave and someone else might come in, and they're really against it, and it's all just changed back to how it was. And rather than being randomly based upon the person in charge and whether they like co-production or not, it should be mandated, by government to say, right, this is the way you need to operate. You know, we've looked at best practice around the country, and we mandate you to actually fund a user-led organisation to run by disabled people for disabled people to give support. And every service that a local authority runs, every service that they commission, even before they commission it, they ought to think of the service user, the end user, and get them around the table with a blank sheet of paper and say, help us, help us actually lay out what the system ought to be, and then they should be part of the commissioning process, the evaluation process, and they should, and then
I feel that when we had that consultation, Don, that we were both at where we met, that was a group of really interesting and diverse people who had a lot to offer, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And we were, and that, yeah, the consultation was led by those two young women who didn't know a thing. They didn't seem to have a clue. They'd just been sent in to do a consultation.
Consultations are often there. You know, it's like you're doing your job perfectly by applying the wet blanket over the issue so that it doesn't get up to the senior managers and the senior leaders. Yeah. Oh, there's no problems. You know, it's fine.
So they sent out a survey, first of all. And you know, we all said, well, the questions in that survey don't make sense to any of us. They're completely irrelevant. But do you remember that, Don?
It's often in a technical language that you just can't make.
No, it wasn't. It was the opposite. It was terribly patronising. It was things like they ended up deciding that one of the big changes that needed to happen was, what was it to do with?
Helping people lose weight.
Sorry?
To help people lose weight.
Help people lose weight, yeah. Because what was the question they'd asked that got them to that?
Well, I didn't get the question down in the first place.
No, I don't think I did either.
How random it is. You know, you think they're going to survey all
adults. They didn't even have a list of people to send it to, did they? So they'd got about a fifth of the people.
Yeah, at most.
And you would assume that these things, I mean, maybe, you know, this is part of the wake-up call more generally. This doesn't just apply to adult social care services. I think this is endemic across a lot of our public services. They've become so focused on, you know, marketing and league table positions and lobbying and things like that, that actually a lot of them now are, you know, kind of it's what it looks like we're delivering rather than what we're actually delivering. But I might be more cynical than most, but I think I'm in good company to support that cynicism. Let me ask you a question, which I think is kind of it kind of goes into the heart of this about a lot of what you describe, and it has a kind of a baseline of an idea of consent. Is that, you know, let's talk to the service user, let's talk to the end user. And it's like, if you just get tacit consent and people don't object, it doesn't mean to say that that person is actually happy or satisfied with it. And what would we replace that with as a yardstick in terms of what actually, and you started off with this, Don, was the idea of what creates the situation for somebody to have an independent and flourishing life? How do we shift the needle over from that side, which says that, well, you know, you just get your payments and therefore your life is up to you to sort out, to saying we need to create the context and the environment where you can have a purposeful, meaningful, enriched life?
I think they need to change the whole philosophy of the way they provide the service, really. And the only way to do that is to get users involved at management level. Because I mean, I've got no idea how it's run. I mean, I've just been on the receiving end. No one's ever said to me, look, come into the office, see from our point of view, this is what we do. Because if they did that, I would say, well, why are you doing A, B, and C? Because that ain't going to work. Do D and E. So at that very high level of management, they need to get users in to give input about where money should best be spent and how it should be spent as well. And again, it's just all down to support. Helping people get support to live the life they want to actually lead, and also making it available and giving them the information so they know where to source the actual support as well. I wouldn't mind, but in some areas, this is being done. You know, there are various parts of the UK where this is being done, so they're not having to reinvent the wheel. All they need to do is copy what they do in, you know, somewhere up north or somewhere down south. It's not complicated.
That was one of the factors that I think has changed about the arguments for a national service to do this, is that in the 1940s, there was probably a good argument that the NHS was centralised in terms of its decision-making process because you couldn't do it any other way, really. You had to have all the clever people in London to crunch the numbers and look at the way it was distributed and things like that. But we've gone through an information revolution where the information can be distributed and you can compare yourself as an organisation or as individuals against other people online, and you can make contact with people independently. You don't need to go through the gatekeepers anymore within central organisations, because you can Google it or whatever. You know, it's like, imperfectly as that is, but it indicates that we don't need that central management mindset anymore. But how do we promote the good practice? So if there is good practice there, how do we hear about it? How do we have conversations about that so that it informs those other people who need to catch up?
to me, it's quite easy. But there was an organisation called the Association of Directors of Adult Social Care. And I've got no idea why they're not sharing best practice. Because they meet up, obviously, at some point, and when they do meet up, what are they sharing? Are they just sharing their holiday photos? I mean, why aren't they sharing best practice? It's just, and again, it's so easy because they must all have an email list where they could just share good practice. And we've seen recently in, I think it's Fulham and Hammersmith, they've just got rid of all their care charges and they're giving care free. And they got rid of charges by just getting rid of staff they didn't need. And they did it. And that's something that could be done around the country. Look at what you're doing. Look at how you're doing it. Do you have too many people? And I think if one area can just stop charging people, other areas could do the same. But it's just a case of learning how they do it. And that could be shared amongst other local authorities.
It's like a kind of, it needs a brave mindset to step into the, it's not the unknown.
Well, I'm not sure it needs to be brave. I mean, I don't think Fulham and Hammersmith are being brave. I think it's just a case of that somehow, whatever they've done, it's worked. And so you just need to replicate it. So you don't need to be brave. Just look at it and say, well, bring it back to our local authority. How can we adapt it to work here and try and make it work?
And be trusting, I suppose, is the word that I would comes to mind with me.
I think trust is what I said at the beginning, you know, that there isn't enough trust of the service unit users to know what they need and what they want for themselves and to be, you know.
Do you have any contact, and this, again, might be an odd question to ask, do you have any contact with any community media groups and organisations? Are you part of a podcast? You know, are you doing a weekly podcast about these issues? Is you part of a network that wants to do YouTube videos and things like that? I mean, it sounds like a topic that would be well received and well, you know, the participation. But there's if you like, there's three levels to community media, and the first one is, and this is the most important one, is how does this feel to the people who are involved in the conversation? Do you feel safe? Can you express your views? You know, are you doing it responsibly and accountably to each other, one another? So, you know, hopefully this conversation feels like that. And then you start to think about the listener or the viewer. And then you can think about the kind of more extended policy platforms that it might connect with, that kind of thing. But the starting point is just to getting people to have a conversation which is shared online.
Yeah, I think these conversations like we're having today, I think they're probably happening in pockets around the county. So there are people who obviously experience the same kind of issues and they're probably talking about the same problems within their small networks, but not through any kind of medium. There's no support there to do a podcast or to you know, even like a newsletter or any kind of Facebook page. But they're just happening in isolation in their various pockets and people are fighting the same struggle around the local authority.
There is, for example, in Oxford, there's the that local carers Oxfordshire booklet that comes around that's supposed to give news for carers. Do you get that?
I have no idea.
You're not a carer, that's why. You're a service user. Yeah. I'm a carer. And so I get that. But, you know, that's full of things like, here's a recipe you can try this week, how to make...
It's not a great leap to say, let's bring a group of people together who've got some... can share recipes, can share tips about things, can talk about the system, and we'll do this as a 40-minute, 50-minute Zoom call each week, and we'll post it up online that people can listen to as they're doing other stuff. I mean, honestly, it's not difficult. I can do it. There's no significant expertise needed for this. And yet the mindset is that... I had a conversation with somebody the other week about dropping in onto a session that they did with some people at risk of homelessness. And we reached the point in the conversation where they said, well, we'll have to pass that through to our marketing and PR department to make sure they're okay with it. I thought, that's it. Over, it's not happening. This person had years of experience of doing safeguarding work. I've got years of experience of doing safeguarding stuff, but we couldn't just get on with it. There needed to be some approval from an assistant in an office who works on a desk who sends out tweets for a living. And I was like,
yeah, around here there's no real support to do anything in any kind of media. And yeah, the idea of, say, in isolation since March last year, people have been behind their door, and there's been no sense of, say, apart from your own personal network, there's been no way to exchange information or find out how to cope with certain problems. And you get an occasional letter from social services, but nothing of note. It's just a shame. And Jane, in your time through coronavirus, what kind of support have you had?
I've had that massive battle about RAF's reassessment, which brought me to tears several times. We had a complete shenanigans with OTs who would, who just, everything was about tick boxes and checking and making sure budgets were used in the way that they thought best and not the way I thought best. And, you know, so all of that went on with the OT department. We went through three different OTs, I think. And I'm sure I've got quite a bad name for myself in Oxfordshire. So we had all that. We had far fewer carers, of course, in the whole 18 months. And so I was doing far more of the care myself. They did, I have to say, let me for the first time, because they don't trust. You can't, if you're a parent or anybody in the family, you're not allowed to pay yourself out of the direct payment. So if you haven't got a carer, the carer's gone off sick or on holiday, and you have to cover, but you're not allowed to be paid from the direct payments. So you have to, you just do it. You know, I get carer's allowance, which is £68 a week, I think. And so I did an awful lot of work. And they did, in fact, in the end, because I asked them to, they let me, under an exceptional circumstances thing, pay myself for a year to do RAF's care. Because I was doing, you know, I only claimed like 50 hours a week, but I was doing probably 60 hours plus nights a week, you know, and that was great. 60
hours plus nights.
Yeah. But then I had, sorry?
60 hours plus nights.
Yeah. Well, nights, if he wakes up at night,
he wants to turn over
and needs the toilet or has a nightmare, or I don't know, he's worried about the dog, or it could be anything, you know, but I very often get woken up in the night. And you know, I find it absolutely exhausting sometimes. But all that time, you know, they let me pay myself and that was fine. But, you know, there was never anybody ringing up and saying, are you okay? How's it going? Or
and you're not part of a network of people. Again, I mean, it's kind of, you know, as you really described eloquently before, was that, you know, people make these assumptions that you'll be a part of a Facebook network that offers advice and tips about this kind of stuff. And it's like, and as you say, it's like you don't want to be constantly online servicing these issues. You want to have a life as well. And the question, I suppose, the question I've got, the last, like, I want to kind of we've got a couple of minutes left, and kind of draw some threads together of what is the, you know, this for yourselves, has there been an enriching, positive engagement that you look back on now and think, actually, that made a difference? And that's the kind of stuff, because often we can, we've got our heads to the grindstone and we're constantly thinking about, you know, planning our strategy for dealing with things, if you like. When it's not easy, you get caught in that. And the next step is to ask, was there anything there that you kind of, you're underappreciating as being something which brought some connection, some joy, some,
there was the odd thing that carried on, like Raphael goes to something called Farmability, and they were the only thing, the only activity of his that carried on throughout the entire 18 months. So I was very grateful for that. Without that, I don't know what we'd have done. So he had 2 days a week at the farm. But I can't think of any. What, you mean from social services?
No, outside the system. Is, you know, you're kind of in your, you know, it's probably a question nobody can answer. But, I mean, actually, my thing is, Don, you wrote a book. You know, that's a remarkable achievement. How many people through lockdown said, I'm going to write a book, you know, and you did. And, you know, it's a really good book and it's a good, solid, it's a very solid piece of research and writing. And, you know, so that came, that something positive has come out of your experience during this very difficult time for everybody, but particularly for people who are in need of care or have to care for other people.
Yeah, from my personal experience, there's been no change in support from the local authority. And over the past year and a half, I wouldn't say that there was more support during the virus, during lockdown. There was more contact from the social worker. There's just been a big void, really, a big gap, and I just had to get on with it on my own, which I can do. But if there is an issue, I can always phone a friend or two, have a similar issue and have a chat to them. But there's been no lasting... I haven't found a new network of people I can turn to if I need any support. It's just been isolation, not just physically, but also socially, and also to sort of try to resolve issues. I generally just get on with it myself because I can, but it's often a long, long process. Now I'm trying to even do an appeal myself through... I just asked for an increase in the direct payment. They said no. I said, well, can you let me know the appeals process? And they said, well, we don't have an appeals process. It's as stupid as that. So you have to complain via a different process, and it's just taken months.
And I suppose the I'll use this word cruelty, is that you can, people's expectations can be inflated, but it's a constant process of deflating and managing down people's expectations. So the rhetoric says, yes, we want this level of engagement, but the practice is, well, but you've got to go through all this layers of bureaucracy and kind of fairly cloth-eared engagement with people who seem not to really understand.
I can give you an example of something that I think illustrates this quite well, although it's a very personal example, but We were allocated in this reassessment that instead of having 3 weeks respite a year, we'd be given six. So you'd think, hooray, great, six whole weeks of respite. But during coronavirus, there has been literally no respite available at all in the entire country for obvious reasons. So I can't send him off to some residential care home. They're not taking people. And if they did, he'd have to self-isolate for 12 days and stay in a room somewhere. So there's been no respite at all. So for 20 months now, I've not had any respite. And I'm really feeling like I'm on my last legs at the moment. And I decided, okay, we've got all that money for all that respite. It's like over £2,000 a week for the respite weeks. And I've arranged that I'm going to take Raf and one of his carers to Scotland, to the Orkney Islands, for 3 weeks. And we're going to just get away. Raf needs to get away from... We haven't left our village. He needs to get away. I need to get away. There's no respite, so we'll both go away with a carer. It'll be a change of scene. We'll, breathe in the sea air and just think, well, at least we're somewhere else. And I've also bringing a friend with me who will help. You know, there's a whole bunch of us going to go up the Orkney Islands and try and get our energy back in some sort of, get out of this state of boredom and just sameness we've been in all this time. And then what do social services say? Oh, well, you can't use any of that money for paying for travel or accommodation. Well, I can only take Raf somewhere if we have a wheelchair accessible place to stay in, which is going to be more expensive. And if I take a carer, do you think she's going to pay her own travel to the Orkney Islands or wherever it is in order to come? I can pay her for care, but I'm not allowed to pay her travel or accommodation.
And what? the money's sitting there.
The money's
nothing
there in our account, but I'm only allowed to use it for care and not for travel or accommodation. Why? Why? When I am organising this as the only possibility of some kind of respite that we can have. I mean, I do intend to argue my case, but this
but also,
is...
I don't think that's true, because when it comes to disability-related expenditure, if there's an expenditure which is to do with the disability, so let's say you need to use the bus, but you need to take the carer with you, you can pay for that bus fare. So it's not true. If you go to the Care Act, you know, Annex C, I think it's paragraph 40. There's a whole list there of expenses that you can actually use.
Oxfordshire actually interpret that Care Act and the direct payments principles for their own, you know, they interpret.
Yeah, but how they interpret it, you just ignore, because, you know, you're not guided by their interpretations. You're guided by the law. And you just say, well, look, this is what the law says. And so I'll go by this.
Well, all I can do is go ahead and I will pay for the accommodation. Yeah, I will pay for the carer travel as well as ours. And then if they, and they will turn around and say, we didn't give you permission for this. You're not allowed to use it for that. And I will just have to fight my case. But the thing is, that's my next big battle coming up.
I'm a big believer in asking not for permission, but for forgiveness. that sometimes doesn't work well with an institution, and we maybe I'm going to wrap up.
I can send you this annex, which lists all the things you can spend the money on, and also I can actually send you a lawyer in London who fought a case for a friend of mine and was successful. That's just your plan B.
Well, that would be very useful. It's just that I really don't look forward to my next battle.
Yeah.
I just want to live my life, and I want us to be happy.
I'm going to assume that you're okay with this information going out in the public domain as well. If it's not, tell me. And because this is the kind of stuff. I mean, we should be talking about this on the radio. You know, there's a great opportunity.
When payments were invented, they said that this should be up to the user. And if they want to use those direct payments to buy a dog for themselves to keep them company, they should be able to do that because that's their choice. My life, my choice.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the problem is that the person who told the information is probably wrong. I would just go ahead with it. And
well, all the social, I've had at least three social workers telling me that. So,
if you ask them, have they actually read the act? And.
I'm going to give the last roundup to Don about the book, which is what do you hope, which is probably what we should have started with, really, was what do you hope this will achieve? As I say, I'm a big fan of the book. I was engrossed. I thought it was great. What do you think, what difference do you hope that it's going to make?
At the moment, the government's going to put out a white paper or green paper about how to improve adult social care. And I was hoping to try to influence government. And I've actually posted a copy of the book to, you know, the all-party parliamentary groups. So I sent a copy to the MPs and House of Lords members who are on the all-party parliamentary groups for adult social care and disability. And I've sent them a letter, copied the book, I've emailed them saying, you know, can I take part in your next meeting to try to influence them? Because the all-party parliamentary group for adult social care has been going since April 2019, and they've made not one bit of difference to my life on a day-to-day basis. So I just want to ask them that question. What difference do you think you've made to people's lives on a day-to-day basis in 2.5 years? Because I can tell the answer is zero. So I just put it out there to help influence change at government level, but also even when it comes to training social workers, because again, I'm on the receiving end of a system, and how social workers are trained, I have no input into how they're trained or what they're taught. But, you know, if this was a book for social work courses, maybe, because the idea of user experiences should be part of social work training, the idea of user voices, how they see the system themselves, and also what they want from a social worker. They try to influence change at government level, try to influence change at how social workers are taught and how they practice as well, and just to hopefully make people's lives better on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I think it will make a contribution towards that. I certainly hope that in doing this podcast and sharing this podcast that we add to that and amplify that as well, and I use whatever means we can to kind of extend the reach of the book as well. I think the question going forward is, you're absolutely right, is what difference does it make? And I kind of promote this on the basis that, you know, we've gone through a pandemic. It's not the only crisis that we're facing. It's not the only crisis that we're going to face. And we have two questions. Are we ready? And can we pay for it? and on both counts, we're really struggling to have clear, coherent ideas. We've got to get to grips. And as the IPCC, the climate change report, said a couple of weeks ago, we need whole-scale systems change at every level of society. And that includes social care, it includes our media, it includes our transport, everything. And we need to figure out very, very quickly, we haven't got long to do this, to change the approach and the attitudes. I'm going to just give a quick indication, plug for the Decentered Media Patreon group. We've started a kind of weekly get together on Zoom, but to get access to it, you've got to subscribe to Patreon. So if you look on Patreon, go to Decentered Media, a bit of a plug there. It covers costs for kind of hosting fees and for refreshments if we have visitors and speakers, but I'll put out more details online over that. So this has been a Decentered Media podcast with me.
Before we go, Rob, sorry, before we go,
yep.
Jane, do you have any lasting words you want to give or want to contribute?
No, I haven't thought of any.
Sorry, I should have asked.
It's no, it's like, fine. I don't know, lasting comment. I don't know. I just thought you've given so much to the podcast, your personal experience, and you can hear the frustration in the way you've spoken.
I just wish my life was easier. In terms of,
that's a great summary. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, it's difficult being a carer of somebody in the family full time. It's really difficult.
Yeah. And yourself, Don?
Yeah, I just think life should be easier for people who use adult social care, and it could be easier if we were more involved in how it's run, how it's planned, and it should be happening. It should be happening now. They should be here, not just hearing our voices, but getting us at the table, having to run it as well.
That's a brilliant place to finish. Thank you very much, Jane and Don. I hope we have another conversation at some point where, Jane, you can tell us about your excursion to the Outer Hebrides. Was it the Outer Hebrides or the Orkneys? The Orkneys. And Don, similarly, at some point, we'll have a travel report from the next place that you're in. You know, I'm watching a load of YouTube videos at the moment of places that I can't go to, but they're fantastic. So until next time, check out decentred.co.uk for the website, or at Decentered Media for Instagram and Twitter. But until next time, thanks very much. You've been listening to the Decentered Media podcast with me, Rob Watson. To find out more, go to decentred.co.uk or follow on Twitter and Instagram at Decentered Media.